Good afternoon. Thank you for coming. And at this point, I'm going to hand over this matter to Justice Rice, who is chair of our Civil Rules Committee.
Thank you very much, Chief Justice Bender. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming today for today's public hearing. This is indeed a public hearing on a proposed civil access pilot project. We've received comments from many of you, and those comments have been distributed to the justices and reviewed by us. In addition, though, a number of you have said that you would like to speak today, and we would like to give you that opportunity. However, because of the number of folks, we're asking you if you could possibly limit your comments to 3 minutes. We would very much appreciate it. The court has a very tough week. So why don't we get started with that being said? And my understanding is the first person who would like to speak is the judge from Denver District Court, Ann Frick. Is that correct, Judge Frick? And we will, just to try to keep you at 3 minutes, give you the 3 minutes on the clock, and we'll have the yellow show up, Judge, at 1 minute. If you just could keep an eye on that, we would appreciate it.
Okay.
Thank you, Judge.
First, I want to thank you all for giving me this opportunity to speak here today. I think everyone in this room is aware that we have very serious problems with our civil justice system. It is fraught with excessive delays, excessive costs, which has all led to a denial of access to our civil justice system to all but the very wealthy or big corporations. And we really need to do something about it. This Colorado pilot project is really geared at trying to solve those problems or address those problems and provide greater access to our civil justice system. The Colorado project began about 3.5 years ago at the American College of Trial Lawyers. At that time, the president of the college established a task force to work hand in hand with the Institute for the Advancement of the American Legal System. Colorado was well represented on that task force. I served on it, Skip Netzorg served on it, and Dick Holmes served on it. And we were there to try to research and work very hard at investigating what the problems were and developing some suggested reforms for addressing those problems. From our research, we learned that there are three major root causes to the problems. First, that the discovery system is broken and needs work. Second, that there's no identification early on in a case of what are the genuine disputed issues. And because of that lack of an early identification of the genuine disputed issues, that's what's led to this massive, unbridled, expensive discovery. And third, that there's a need for much more active judicial case management. So then we come to Colorado, and about 1.5 years ago, we started established the committee of the Civil Access Pilot Project Committee. We divided into half of us to work on a pilot project for business cases and the other half to work on a pilot project for medical malpractice cases. And all of our pilot project rules are really geared to try to address those three root causes. Now, I have reviewed the comments that were submitted to you all last Friday, and many of them are well taken. And our committee is prepared to suggest some changes, minor changes to some of our rules if the court would like us to do so. Specifically, I think we need to clarify that, yes, employment cases and construction defect cases are excluded from the pilot project. I think we need to clarify that the certain rules of timing, specifically for the timing of when a responsive answer or a motion to dismiss is due, I think we need to clarify what that time is. And third, we need to make clear that what's discoverable from an expert's file is consistent with what the new change in the federal rules is, which we think Colorado is likely to adopt that change. That change protects the draft reports of an expert and some other work product materials, and it protects certain communications between the counsel and the expert. And we don't want to be inconsistent with those changes.
I'm very sorry to break you off, but we have so many people. Thank you so much for coming today. Mr. Dickinson, thank you, sir.
Thank you. Just for background, I've done insurance defense practice for 35 years. The last 25, I've specialized in medical malpractice defense. So I've been on the committee. I got involved, not directly through my Colorado practice, but because of a national involvement in the American Board of Trial Advocates, which is a group of 6,500 attorneys, both from defense and plaintiff side. One of its principles is preservation of the civil jury trial. And through our work on this over the years, obviously we've become concerned with access to the courts as part of that problem. You can't preserve the right without having access. And so I'm actually heading up a committee at the national level on this issue and began doing research with the National Center of State Courts and became aware of the American College survey and their subsequent pilot project rule format, and became aware that this was really focused in Colorado with Becky Corliss's group. And so I got myself involved on that basis to see how I could help. I got myself on the committee. And during the committee process, we decided that medical malpractice would also be an area to look at, as well as commercial cases, because of the heavy expense of expert discovery. And so we started crafting rules along those lines. And I've read all the comments as well. Some of the issues that have been raised that will be discussed by later speakers are concerned about the timing of the disclosure processes and also commonality. And as been mentioned, I think we can make some adjustment on the disclosure timing. Commonality can be addressed by making it clear that the endorsement of experts and the expert conference take place after the close of fact discovery, so basically everything is known that's going to be known. The primary concern that's been raised is the proposed lack of expert depositions. And the reason for that is the expense that creates for that process itself, and because in our practice, we all end up taking depositions up until a month or even weeks before trial. And so while we're trying to figure out what the case is about, we're spending a lot of money getting ready for trial. So one of the goals of the pilot project was to eliminate the need for expert depositions by requiring certified expert reports and exchanging expert files, which is the primary reason most depositions are taken. And if we can eliminate that, we resolve a lot of cost, and we are able to evaluate our cases quickly and decide whether or not to go to trial or to settle. And so that is the solution. Certainly there are some trade-offs. I know everybody that's going to speak, and I respect them, but we feel that this is worth an effort, because if we dedicate ourselves to getting reports and having reliable reports, we can all learn how to do this and take care of our clients on both sides at much less expense, and allow these cases to be brought and resolved on their merits, not because of the expense.
Thank you, Mr. Dickinson. Let's see, and I think Chief Judge Bob Hyatt from Denver District Court is up next. Thank you for coming to speak, Judge.
Thank you, Justice Rice, Chief Justice, and members of the court. I just want to make a couple of points to supplement what my newest colleague, or one of my newer colleagues, Judge Frick, has had to say. First of all, let me tell you that all of our judges are very enthusiastic about this program. They all stand ready to implement the proposed rules in all of our civil courtrooms if this court proceeds with these rules. As you know, that sort of unanimity is somewhat rare, but we have had a chance to examine these proposed rules. We have read them carefully. We have discussed them among ourselves. And we have listened to the explanation for the rationale and the origin of the rules. And we like, in short, what we have seen, what we have read, and what we have heard. Secondly, what we also know, based on our collective experience, is that convoluted discovery and extraordinary costs of civil litigation are serious problems for us in terms of our access to the courts and in terms of proportionality. This is not a surprise. We have known this for a very long time. It's not a surprise to us that we currently try less than 1% of our civil filings. We don't try civil cases anymore. We do deal with protracted discovery disputes. We do set and reset our trials literally years out so that we can accommodate not our own dockets, but the attorney's extensive and complex and complicated expert deposition schedules, both in the case that they have before us and in their other cases. And as we do all that, we essentially say to ourselves, this is broken and it needs to be fixed. Most importantly, let me tell you that we, having thought about this, have no better idea. As trial judges down there in the trenches, we complain, we bemoan, though in our collective wisdom, and we are occasionally innovative, have no plan B. We have no other better way or better notion on how to fix this. I have spoken with chief judges and judges from around the metropolitan area. I think I speak on behalf of Chief Judge Brooke Jackson in Jefferson County, Judge Phelps in Adams, and Judge Sylvester in Arapahoe County when I say to you that the proposal seems to our judges, to our trial judges, to be an important way to correct our course in civil litigation. We believe it's a worthy effort. We also, I think, collectively believe that we're not being responsible and we're not being accountable if we continue to do nothing about our notion of how civil litigation ought to work. Thank you all.
Could I just ask you a question on this? I think it's, I didn't tell you I was going to ask you this question, so I apologize. I'm curious how Denver is going to handle the change of dockets on term day among the civil judges when they rotate out. I noticed that Denver's excluded from the rules on trying to keep one judge on one case.
Well, not so much excluded, but I think the rules recognize our rotation system to which we are wedded. As a former colleague on that bench, I know you know that the rotation system is important to us and we think it works well in Denver. But we don't think that precludes having one judge stay with the case in most instances for a variety of reasons. One, in making assignments for 2011, I had an eye on keeping rotations in place, civil rotations, and accommodating at least a two-year pilot project. Secondly, our civil rotation is ordinarily longer than any other rotation, and that's where judges ordinarily spend the most time. Third, and perhaps most importantly, we think trials will occur more quickly under these proposed rules. We think we will bring cases to trial more quickly without some of the problems that I talked about a moment ago, allowing the judges in that courtroom to stay with that case, to manage that case, to hear that case. And obviously, at some point in the future, there will be some rotation and some judges will move out of civil.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I second. Chief, yes. I'm too concerned about the rotation in Denver. And are there steps that you can take to ensure that judges, if we accept this pilot project, in fact stay with the case and not get transferred?
I think what I can tell you is that judges will stay with the case for as long as practicable in Denver. That doesn't mean there will never be a rotation. It doesn't mean we are that they'll stay there for 10, 12 years. You know, at the end of every judge's term,
there's always a statute of limitations. Sure.
Right. Judges leave, things happen. but I think we can make a concerted effort to make sure that judges' civil rotation is longer than the other rotations. I think the bench as it currently exists is made up in a fashion that allows me to keep judges in civil a little longer than we have previously. I think we can accommodate these rules.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, our next speaker is Chief Judge Jackson from the First. Judge Jackson, thank you.
Thank you, Justice Wright. May it please the court. I'm Brooke Jackson. I'm the Chief Judge in the First Judicial District, which is Jefferson and Gilpin counties. We do not have a rotation system. We have a mixed docket system, and in fact, 12 of our 13 judges have civil dockets as part of their overall mix. I was not a member of the committee that drafted these proposed pilot rules, but I do know, I think, most of the people who were, and I think they are some of the fine, respected members of our bar and bench here in the metro area. When I presented, when I was informed of these pilot rules and I presented them to my colleagues in Jefferson County, unanimously, the 12 judges who do civil cases in JEFCO enthusiastically said they hoped that they could participate. And I might say that this comes from a group of nine with primarily criminal backgrounds, and three, one of which is myself, with a primarily civil background. I did have a chance to read through all of the comments. And again, I, like Judge Frick and others, I respect those comments. I know several of the commentators. They're wonderful lawyers. And I think they made good points. Some of them are now apparently moot. I didn't realize that construction and employment cases were going to be excluded, but that takes care of some of the issues, it seems. But I understand the points that were made. Let me say, from the standpoint of the trial bench, that these rules are going to be more work for us, too. We're going to have to do what maybe we should be doing already, and that is really roll up our sleeves and be actively involved in early case management. We're going to have the responsibility to impose sanctions where people don't comply. But it's one of those situations, I think, where the bench and the bar have an opportunity, and that opportunity is to do something for the good of the system, to put aside what might seem to be for our own individual benefit or convenience, and to do something that's going to really benefit the entire system. I think we ought to give this a try. If it doesn't work, we can scrap it. If it doesn't work well, we can fix it. But I think it's an opportunity to do something that's never been done before, and that is to make some of these rules mandatory, to make them difficult but fair, and on behalf of my court, we hope you'll adopt them. Thank you for letting me speak.
Thank you very much, Chief. And another chief, Chief Judge Phelps from the 17th. Is he here? Yes, there he is.
Thank you, Justice Rice. And members of the court, thank you for giving me the opportunity. I probably won't need to take 3 minutes of your time today because I believe that Chief Judge Hyatt and Chief Judge Jackson have probably summed up most of what I had in mind to say to you anyway. I just want to express to all of you that the 17th is firmly behind this project. And I must confess, when I first heard about it and read about it, I wondered if we were going to be able to get people on board that were going to have to use the system in the courts. And then I saw who was on the committee. And now I've talked to all those people on that committee. And they're all dedicated, and they've all worked very, very hard and thought through this very, very carefully. I've also had an opportunity to review the comments that were filed, and like my colleagues, I know many of those lawyers and respect all of them. And I also would tell you all that that many of those suggestions struck a resonant chord with me, and I know with members of the committee. But I'm also convinced of the fact that if the system does need to be tweaked a bit, and it may, that we have some people who are capable of doing that, and hopefully at the end of these proceedings, we'll have a much better idea where it needs to go and how it needs to get there. I thank you for the time.
Thank you very much. There is no one here from the 18th, is that correct? All right. Then we'll switch to some of the attorneys who wish to speak, and the first one is Scott Sullen. Scott Sullen is going. Can you not hear me in the back?
Thank you,
Mr. Sullen.
Members of the court, may it please the court, my name is Scott Sullen. My practice is limited to construction defect litigation, and so it may well be that that my comments are moot, and I would ask the court whether a decision has already been made to exclude construction defect actions from the pilot project. If so, then I don't want to beat a dead horse. If not, or if you would be interested in knowing some of the reasons why the pilot project isn't appropriate for construction defect cases, I'd be happy to address those.
Why don't you take your 3 minutes, if you would, sir. Thank you.
First, construction defect actions are unique in Colorado. I don't know of any other type of action which is subject to a pre-suit notice process and a pre-suit, in effect, mediation process. Construction defect actions are governed, as you know, by the Construction Defect Action Reform Act. Prior to filing suit, we must give the construction professionals involved a detailed notice which sets forth the defects, their general location if known, and any damage caused by those defects. And so the key element that was discussed by the judge who spoke first, I think Judge Frick was her name, that there be an early identification of issues is accomplished in construction defect actions even before the suit is filed. The construction professional then has an opportunity to come in, examine the property, make an offer if they so choose. Often that process is extended by agreement of the parties, sometimes for up to a year and a half, resulting in settlement of the case.
This is before the filing of the case?
Yes, that's right. You can extend it by agreement, and it often is, before filing the case, because once you file the notice of claim, the statute of limitations and repose are told by statute. Okay. In addition, once the case is filed, another list of defects needs to be provided to the defendants. Now, overlaying that, the pilot project then has all of these requirements regarding disclosing material facts and how you plead and so forth. We already face a plethora of motions that are filed regarding the adequacy of notices of claim and so forth. I would suggest to you that this model pilot project is going to confuse the courts, is going to add to the complexity with regard to those initial motions. We've got a statute, we're following it, we should stick to that. Second, there's an unintended consequence in not taking experts' depositions in construction defect action claims. What we do to try to settle these claims is get the experts in a room, subject to a confidentiality order, and say, talk freely and figure out how to fix this building without fear that it's going to be used against you in court later.
Is that an informal agreement? Is that building in the rules or statutes or what?
What we do is we go to the court and we get a confidentiality agreement imposed, and we usually have a mediator conduct the session so that it's governed by the mediation privilege under the statute. And that way the experts can take off any advocacy hat and they can talk frankly, because what we're after is getting the building fixed, not just, you know, putting in more piers or pilings or whatever. But if we know that the other side is going to get a free shot at questioning our expert in one of these Plan B sessions, I know we won't permit our experts to attend those sessions, nor will any of the defendants. Why would they? They can cloak their expert behind the door of no expert discovery, and in effect, these Plan B discussions are the ultimate in discovery. And so the unintended consequence of that rule is that you're going to foreclose our Plan B process. And the Plan B, by the way, was a name coined by me years ago. And the idea was, plaintiffs have their Plan A, defendants have their Plan A, let's get to a Plan B and let's get the case resolved and let's get the attorneys out of the way and let's let the engineers, architects, and construction professionals figure that out. And the best people to do that were the experts.
Any additional questions? Mr. Sullivan, thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, moving right along, Chris Rohde, please.
Thank you, Your Honors. Mr. Sullivan hit most of the points that I was going to hit, so I won't take most of your time. I will just add one additional thing. I also work in the area of construction defect litigation, representing homeowners throughout Colorado and homeowners associations. In these actions, as governed by the Construction Defect Action Reform Act, a measure of damages is the cost of repair. That measure of damages cannot be established firmly until there's been significant discovery, testing, and expert opinions. And under the pilot project rule 2, it would require us to plead all material facts that are known to a party early on, including monetary damages. It would be very difficult to do in a construction defect case, and therefore we respectfully request that construction defect actions be excluded.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, now Mr. Overton, Thomas Overton. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Justice Rice, members of the court. First of all, I applaud this pilot program and strongly suggest that you adopt it. I want to address this from the standpoint of someone that does primarily business litigation in a small firm context. I agree with what Judge Frick had to say, that this is a lot that has to do with access to justice.
and cost, and my concerns really address timing on the front end. As a practical matter, I think it's important to understand how clients come into a small firm like mine. They typically have been to another lawyer, either for cost reasons or because they went to a general practitioner or otherwise. They get to me even now a week before the answer is due. We have to take time, usually a day or two, to get a retainer agreement written, signed, in place, and then we have a day or two left. The way these rules operate on the front end, as I understand them, a complaint is filed and served, and then a proactive plaintiff within a day or two could file their disclosures, and then I'd have a motion to dismiss potentially due within 15 days of that, or even possibly even less than the 20 days we normally get to answer now. In a firm like mine, when I'm often set for a week of depositions or 2 weeks of depositions, and we only have one or two other lawyers available, and they have their own cases, I simply can't take that case. And it may be that, the client is precluded from hiring me, even though I may be able to do it more cost-effectively than a large firm. And what I would urge you to do is think about a mechanism that will allow us on the front end to maybe have an extra 15, 20 days so that we can fully evaluate an appropriate motion to dismiss and recognize that we may not get this case before the time runs. Other than that, I think it's a great program, and I think we can deal with the deadlines. But I am concerned about clients coming to a small firm. Not as a practical matter, we can't take that case because of the time deadlines. I'm about out of time. I do want to mention on the expert side, I also think that's just a fantastic way to approach things, but it's going to take the courts, the trial courts, actually enforcing the rule and precluding testimony if it's not properly disclosed. What we see now, more often than not, is since something's not disclosed in the report and the courts, for whatever reason, allow the expert to testify at trial. So we're forced to take a deposition, and I would encourage this court to insert some language encouraging the trial courts to hold the expert's feet to the fire when it comes to testifying beyond the scope of their expert report. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Overton. Let's see, Richard Strauss, please. Mr. Strauss, counsel.
Good afternoon.
Please, the court. I, too, am a small firm practitioner. I have a primarily commercial litigation practice, so this pilot program would fall right in my bailiwick. I applaud the concept of improving access to justice, access to our court system in civil cases. I applaud some of the rules. You know, I've been practicing for 33, almost 34 years, and during that period of time, we've undergone a number of rule changes in the civil rules of procedure, and we've dealt with them, and we've learned how to deal with them, and we've learned how to use them. As I said in my written comments to the court, I do have some concern about the trial courts having the time and the resources and really the commitment to enforcing this new set of rules, which are pretty stringent. I'm encouraged to hear the chief justices, the chief judges of several of the districts in which I practice, that they enthusiastically support this. I question down the road how that's actually going to work in practice, because I know since I applied for a judgeship, how overburdened the court system is. They don't have law clerks, they don't have clerks, they don't have reporters, and the resources are just not there to, I think, take the kind of active case management posture that these rules contemplate. But like me, I'm sure that they would deal with the situation if these are enacted. I have complaint about two specific of the rules. Number one, the inability to take depositions of experts. And I do think that my concern from what I've heard and what I read in some of the other comments can be mitigated somewhat if you put in a requirement that not only does the expert report have to basically lay out what they're going to testify to on direct examination, but then produce their file subject to whatever work product considerations the committee wants to put on them, but also put on the requirement that the expert give his opinion under oath. That way, It could be used in a motion for summary judgment, and I do think if it was sworn testimony under oath or sworn report under oath, that might actually minimize the need to take the depositions of those experts. The second rule that I have a problem with is the requirement that the case keep going even though there's a motion to dismiss under Rule 12 that's filed. It's happened, I'm sure every lawyer in this room could give you war story after war story about filing a Rule 12 motion and the case just sits and sits and sits. And meanwhile, if you had to be going through all the case management conferences and the disclosure requirements and whatever discovery was allowed during that period of time, only to have the court grant your Rule 12 motion because it didn't have subject matter jurisdiction or jurisdiction over one of the parties, that would just increase the cost of litigation needlessly. So I would ask that, you know, that part of the rule be reconsidered. But other than that, If you enact them, you enact them.
Well, that's true. Yes. All right, Mr. Strauss, thank you very much. Turning to the court reporters, Kathy Davis, please. Thank you for coming today.
May it please the court. I'm Kathy Davis, the president of the Colorado Court Reporters Association. We appreciate the opportunity to be here today. Our association is comprised mostly of two groups, officials who work in the court system and freelancers who take depositions. What we have to offer you today is our years of experience in court and in deposition. And this experience tells us that Rule 10-1D of this pilot project will not be good for the people of the state of Colorado as litigants or as taxpayers. In my 30 plus years as a court reporter, I have worked as an official in the Boulder courts way back in the day when I was the court reporter and your lawyer, Judge Haller, was the law clerk for Mike and Law. And for 25 years, I have worked as a freelancer doing depositions. As you might imagine, I've seen it all and more. In all seriousness, though, that's why CCRA feels it has helpful information for you today. Court reporters see more deposition and trial testimony than anyone. We see cases settle based upon discovery, deposition, testimony of an expert witness. We see the issues of misinformation and lacking information come to light in the deposition. We see witnesses lie under oath. More cases will go to trial if attorneys are not allowed to test their cases through the deposition process. I have seen firsthand the 7-hour deposition of an expert witness pared down to 1 hour of trial testimony. However, without that 7 hours, of inquiry and probing out of court, the attorney would not know the relevant questions to pose during trial and would have to conduct his or her discovery of the expert during cross-examination in front of the judge and jury. Expert testimony can be confusing enough without extraneous issues being explored during the trial for possible relevance. This discovery cross-examination at trial will increase the length of trials, frustrating the judges, and forcing jurors to take more time away from their work and lives. And while money may be saved in the discovery process, the cost of trying a case will rise. We believe that forcing attorneys to rely solely on the expert witness report filed before trial will cause more motions related to expert reports to be filed before, during, and after trials, further clogging the court system. How will an attorney file a Schreck motion without deposition testimony? Our view is that it will become an automatic motion, and the judge will hear what should have been deposition testimony in the form of a motion in limine. Discovery cross-examination of an expert witness will cost either way. Rather than 95% of cases settling, 80 to 90% will settle. Rather than a trial lasting 5 days, it will now go for 6 days. Will the parties bear the cost of proving their own cases, or will that burden fall upon the backs of the Colorado taxpayers as the discovery process is moved into the court system? Thank you.
Thank you for coming. I think we have another court reporter who'd like to speak to us, Jason Meters. Did I say that correctly, sir? All right, thank you.
May it please the court.
I've been a reporter in the civilian world for over 30 years now. My experience has gone over thousands of days of trial and thousands of depositions. And I know that we have the self-interest in being in front of you and talking about the deposition process and the proposal of this pilot project. But I would also ask that you recognize our unique perspective. We have all this experience, and we have a unique perspective on the system, an eagle's eye view, if you will. We don't have an advocacy role. Our only advocacy is the record that we produce. And from our perspective, we can see abuses. We can see marked effectiveness of what's going on with the system. And we would have any number of suggestions to offer you in terms of improving accessibility and in terms of improving affordability and cutting down the abuses that we see in the system. We would be happy to help if invited to the table. In our collective experience, every day we see experts who disclaim the disclosures that have been presented for them, who have, as it turns out, no scientific basis for the reports that they've generated, who have ancillary opinions that go that don't go as far as the report would seem to indicate, or goes farther than the report would indicate. Those come out in depositions. A hallmark of examination of attorneys at trial is, if you don't know the answer to the question, don't ask the question. If you don't know the answer that you glean in depositions, then you are getting out a major effectiveness that lawyers have in conducting their examinations in court. I've seen in my over 30 years of civilian experience as a court reporter, depositions go from a focus of trial preparation to a focus of settlement evaluation. There are far more settlements now than trials, and that's a good thing, or the system will be overburdened. But I would also ask you to consider that depositions, properly narrowed and properly focused, play a vital role in both of those aspects. And listening to Mr. Sullivan, too, just note that if the pilot project is reasonably happy with the construction aspect of litigation, I think you can also take his words to heart in terms of how they approach it and the stress that it brings to the system, the way they do things, and the way that accessibility and affordability can be improved. And perhaps it sends a warning, too, of the weaknesses that may be inherent to the proposals within the pilot project. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for coming down here today. Appreciate it. Let's see, Mr. Truar, Robert Truar.
Thank you, Justice Rice. Chief Justice Bender and Justices of the Court, thank you for this opportunity to talk to you directly. As my letter stated, I am the current president of the Plaintiff Employment Lawyers Association. I've been in practice for 30 years. The last 25 years have all emphasized employment law or labor law. And I did have an opportunity to bring this pilot project and its rules to the attention of all the members of our association and get some feedback. And at this time, I couldn't feel any more supported than the fact that a co-chair of the business section, the Honorable Judge Frick, has said, we're ready to take employment cases out. But I know that's the decision of this court, so I'll just take a minute to tell you a couple reasons why I would say that that is a good decision at this time. And that is the request primarily of the plaintiff employment bar to just be excluded at this time. We have some uniquenesses to our cases, as everyone can claim, but some of them could be pointed out and be helpful. First of all, employment cases include, at least as a mainstay, two types of cases, wage claims and discrimination claims. Colorado has a strong wage claim act that was amended extensively 3 years ago, and that act has unique parts to it whereby early in the case, a demand within 60 days of an employer, even an employer, makes a demand to preserve a penalty, and if the employer doesn't pay within 14 days, another very short period, those penalties could incur in litigation later. So there is a lot of front-end talk to try and resolve cases. But what's pointed out here is that at the end of that, if the parties haven't resolved it, they're usually saying, we don't even believe there's an agreement for some type of compensation that's being asked. And that's one of the differences where the typical, if there is such a thing, business case. At least in a business case, the parties might both know what agreement they're arguing over. In employment cases, there usually has to be some unique discovery in order to ferret out the agreement of a complete compensation plan. Comparably, in discrimination cases, under the state law, which is what would be at issue here, you have to first file a charge with the Colorado Civil Rights Division, and that investigation is at least 6 months long and usually 9 months to a year long. And if the parties can't resolve it at the end of that, it's usually because one party will say, we have no bias whatsoever, and we don't know what you're talking about. And the employee says, well, I have to now prove your intent, which is different than most business cases, not just a failure to perform, but I have to prove your intent through circumstantial evidence. And so the object of interrogatories and requests to produce and discovery usually is needed from the attorney's point of view in an employment case. So we ask that we get to have more input into this before they're included, and to have an appendix of documents that would need to be produced. Thank you.
I have a question.
Yes.
Let's assume that eventually, if this works, it's expanded to other fields.
Yes.
So, my concern is these exclusions that catch me by surprise. Why shouldn't we run a test of some employment cases to see if in fact it works or it doesn't work? I mean, that's what a pilot project is about.
That's correct, Your Honor. In this case, when I read the article that introduced it in the Colorado Lawyer, it appeared from the article that the cases that they thought would be helpful to test at this time were medical malpractice cases and business cases.
Right.
And I read it not knowing our employment cases even thought about. So I called all four of the chairs, the two in the malpractice and two of this, and just asked that question. And it appeared that they had not been thinking of employment cases in fashioning the rule to the same extent that they had thought of other business cases. And therefore, perhaps they weren't looking at those kinds of cases to make sure the rule would work even as a pilot project. And that's shown by the fact that there's no appendix that would ask for certain documents that would be quite different from just regular business documents. So we need time to develop that so that we don't mess up any cases in the meantime. That's why I would say it should be kept out now.
Thank you.
Ms. Truelar, in your letter, you suggest some specific language
Yes.
that should be excluded. And I just wonder, have you vetted that with other people? I mean, I'm not...
I actually had vetted language that was much longer than that with the members of my Bar Association, but then on a conference call with Mr. Netzog and Her Honor Judge Frick, she said, how about this? And that I tried to fashion after exactly what she suggested. So it's been vetted through the committee to that extent.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you, Mr. Truelar. Let's see, Charles Goldberg, please.
Justice Rice, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Charles Goldberg. I appear here today on behalf of the business groups, which are litigation groups of Rockefeller, Johnson, and Lyons. We have previously placed before this court our letter of comments and endorsement, and I'll be very brief. I simply wanted to report to the court that we appreciate the efforts of everyone who's been involved. There are many, many fine minds who have wrestled with this problem for many, many years. Over my four-plus decades of experience as a former judge and as a trial lawyer, I witnessed two transformative events, really, in the trial practice in my life or my career. First has been the fact that when I first started, we used to try cases by ambush, trial by fire, and we got to trial in 6 to 9 months. Of course, that's radically changed. The second transformative event has been in the earlier days of my career, lawyers, in effect, managed the judicial docket. They decided what the discovery schedules were. They decided whether a case could be settled or not. They decided when to apply for trial. And it worked very well. Of course, today, the action is in the mountains of paper that are exchanged, the discovery disputes and so forth. So we think that this is a positive, bold step forward. We think it's an experiment worth trying, and we hope the court will adopt it. However, we do offer one one suggestion, and that is like any pilot project, there can be unintended or unforeseen consequences. And with that in mind, should that come to the court's attention, we would ask that this matter, that if you adopt this project, that you hold another public hearing even earlier than the expiration of the two-year term. It may not be possible, may not be practical, there may not be enough statistics developed. But if there are problems, I think it ought to be considered. And certainly, at the end of the initial 2 years, rather than just letting things go as usual, we would ask that a public hearing be held and considered, and we have another assemblage just like this so that the court can hear from the public, from litigants, from the lawyers involved. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Goldberg. All right, Julia Thompson, please. Ms. Thompson?
Thank you, Justice Rice. May it please the court. My name is Julia Thompson. I am a plaintiff's attorney practicing primarily in the area of medical negligence. I have four issues to discuss, most of which are related to reading the comments of my colleagues on the other side. In terms of the issue of timing, many cases involved in medical negligence are brought to the attention of either the defendant or even the defendant's counsel prior to being filed. During discovery process in a medical negligence case, often an issue of peer review comes up as to whether or not an investigation that was performed with relation to the alleged negligence occurred. And often when a Hawkins letter was provided to the defendant. A Hawkins letter is a letter written by a lawyer early on outlining an investigation that should go into the incident. So in terms of knowledge of the case, often the defendant and his or her attorney may know about the case early on, and therefore some of the issues of timing can be addressed at that point. Secondly, in terms of the cost of discovery, the expert discovery costs are what will foreclose access to the court for many plaintiffs. When meeting with potential clients and explaining what the costs will be to go into litigation, what we look at is what the expert costs will be, not only the retention of the experts, but the deposition process. And part and parcel in that is the number of experts that we see being endorsed by both the plaintiffs and the defendants, often somewhat cumulative, but with enough of a difference that they can pass the test of exclusion by the court. Taking the depositions of all these experts is the most expensive part of these cases, and these pilot project rules address that, as also discussed by Mr. Dickinson. Finally, the issue is the impact that a judgment against a physician may have on his professional license or her professional license. I have for you just a compilation of what's called the Skolnick disclosures that physicians make with respect to settlements. It's a compilation of just seven doctors that I was able to obtain names of that had perhaps been sued multiple times. Of these seven defendants, they all still have active licenses. They are all still practicing here in Colorado. Well, excuse me, one of them does not, but they also all have insurance. So, and all of these seven physicians, they either settled 3 to 5 to 6 claims and it had no impact on their license. They're all actively licensed in Colorado. So the argument that a settlement may adversely impact a physician may be true in certain isolated instances, but in most instances, the physicians that are sued are maybe sued once in their career. There is no impact on their license. And so these rules will not preclude these doctors from defending themselves, nor will they have an impact on their license. And I can provide these to the court if you'd like to see them.
Do you have seven copies? If you could just leave those with Susan Gleason and one of the people at the back table on your way out, they'll give them to us. That'd probably be the easiest way.
Okay. Thank you.
And thank you very much. Any questions? All right, thank you. Mr. Fogg, Mark Fogg.
Thank you, Justice Rice.
Counsel.
May it please the court, members of the committee. I thank the court for the public hearing and the opportunity to provide input, and I thank the members of the committee for the public service that they provided. The input that we provide in the spirit of trying to make this the best product possible if the pilot program moves forward. First thing I really want to applaud in the pilot project rules is the emphasis on early judicial intervention, coordination of the case, and the concept of fact-based pleading. That is something we have tried to accomplish in the existing rules for some time, really with little success. We oftentimes have disagreement. I've been a trial lawyer for approximately 25 years representing physicians, and a disagreement we often have at this point in time is over the production of medical records or informal interviews under Reuter and Sams. Clearly, there needs to be an expeditious and efficient way of handling those problems very early on in the litigation, at least by the conference, the initial conference, or shortly thereafter, because currently the system is not going to work if we do not address those. The other thing I've asked for the committee and the court to reconsider is the issue of deposing retained experts. From a medical malpractice standpoint, that is a key point in the evaluation of the case. Certainly, there are many cases where we know the case should be resolved early on, and there are many cases that we know that the case should be defended. However, there are a large majority of cases in which we do not know if the case should be resolved or defended. And the evaluation of deposing the retained expert is key. Oftentimes, the physician attends those expert depositions and helps us in making the decision for the physician, for the patient, and for the court of whether that case should be resolved or defended. I have tracked that debate for many years of deposing retained experts or not, and I believe there has been abuse in that area. We have many videotaped depositions, we have 7-hour depositions, we have extreme expert costs, but to move the pendulum completely across and say no, an absolute prohibition, will make it very difficult to evaluate these cases.
What's the halfway point, though?
I would suggest to the court a number of alternatives, and I think Pat O'Rourke, University Counsel, in his written comments, made some very good practical suggestions. Clearly, we need to limit the time with regard to expert depositions. The 7 hours is abusive, and we need to place that down into perhaps the 3-hour area. Limitations on the number of deposition experts that can be deposed. Also, an alternative of having the party who endorses the expert be the one that pays for the deposition costs. I mean, one reason under the interprofessional code, et cetera, that we have that the other side pays is because we can't control the time that the party may take in taking the deposition. However, if there are strict limitations placed on how long that deposition should be, and the party that endorses the expert pays for the cost, that would help ameliorate the expenses and the abuse that is currently occurring.
Mrs. Rice.
Yes, please.
As far, you know, in terms of evaluation of your case, I guess the question I have is, why can't it be done with a detailed affidavit, whether it's under oath or endorsed on each paragraph? And it seems to me a striking anomaly that in a criminal case, we have all kinds of experts, and we can put someone to death, and all you get is a report. You don't take a deposition. So I don't, and I know you know that. And I just wonder why the same kind of evaluation that you're talking about can't be performed under these rules, or maybe some rules that maybe, you know, make them a little stronger. And I'd like you to comment on that, because it's a little troubling.
In our evaluation of the medical malpractice cases, Your Honor, it is key for us to be able to evaluate that expert witness and how that expert witness will testify, and even more important with regard to the physician themselves, being able to evaluate how that physician will testify and whether that physician makes sense with regard to the issues of the case.
Well, why do we make a special exception to make that, you know, that look-see evaluation that you're talking about?
Well, the court has
in this particular area, as opposed to others. Well, I respect your expertise. and you represent, I think, a substantial body of an issue that has been raised. So that's why I'm asking you this.
And the court has emphasized numerous times in opinions issued by the court that medical malpractice is a unique area in which expert testimony is key. Medical records, expert testimony, and evaluation of the case are key in this particular area, and it is pivotal for us to be able to evaluate these witnesses with regard to their opinions for purposes of motions, for purposes of motion in limine, and purposes of evaluating the expert's opinions.
So can I summarize your objection? Really isn't to the content of the report. Here, you want an eyeball observation that's seen by the lawyers as well as your physician client. Is that fair?
Clearly, it's not a black and white determination, Judge. And I do think in this particular area there needs to be an evaluation of the expert themselves. Yes. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Fogg. Next speaker today is Steve McCarrick. Did I say that correctly, Steve?
You did, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Justice Rice, members of the court, members of the committee. I'm also an attorney who practices in the area of medical malpractice with Kennedy, Childs, and Fogg, defending health care providers. I'm going to focus my comments sort of in addition to Mr. Fogg's comments, because we agree that there are a lot of favorable aspects to the committee's recommendations. I'd like to focus on some modifications to the proposed rules that can make this process even better for the good of the system, as we've heard earlier today. There's two major points I'd like to focus on. One is the factual discovery in the case. I know that in the criminal system, which we've talked about, it's a much more efficient system, and we'd like to be more like that system in the civil case. But I think one of the things that makes it that way is there's full disclosure at the outset. And one of the things we struggle with is that in the civil case, in light of the Alcon decision, Spicer decision, some of those decisions, there's more limited disclosure and redaction of records. And in personal injury cases, that may be applicable, but I'm not sure that's appropriate for medical cases, because that's not the way medicine is practiced. Physicians don't get a limited history. They don't get redacted information. They have to diagnose and treat based upon the whole patient, the whole history, and all of the information. And the problem is, when we get into litigation for a medical case, we're getting redacted records, limited records, and then we're trying to get expert reviews based upon that, and that's not the way the medicine was practiced. So one proposal I would have is that for specifically medical malpractice cases, there be complete disclosure of medical information at the outset of the case for 5 years, whatever the court thinks is appropriate, and put a protective order in place that can't be disclosed any further.
So you'd want us to overrule those cases, which we do likewise? I mean,
not overrule them, Your Honor.
How would you deal with that?
Modify them for medical cases so that there's a limited period of time that all of the medical information that the treating healthcare providers have can be disclosed to the experts, so they have the same benefit of reviewing that information and making judgments about the care, the diagnosis, and the cause of whatever the poor outcome was. The difficulty is that many conditions, if there's a nerve injury following a medical procedure, may be caused by the medical procedure, but it may be caused by an underlying endocrine condition or something else. That's why the disclosure is important. With regard to expert discovery, some states have moved more towards health courts and more expertise in deciding cases. That's why I think depositions of experts are important, because we're asking lay jurors to come into court, six people, and decide complex medical issues about standard care, causation, with limited knowledge. The medical providers go to school for 10 to 12 years to be trained to address these complex issues. There are many different schools of thought about treatment, causation, what causes outcomes. That's why I think experts are so important in medical cases as opposed to maybe criminal cases or other types of cases. That's why I think it is important to be able to endorse specialists per expert in each area and have those deposed so that people can explore those issues, explore those schools of thought, get a better understanding of those issues, and refine that for presentation to our jurors who don't have the benefit of 12 years of medical education to decide these complex issues. Those are the two main areas I wanted to focus on, Judge, and I think my time's up.
All right, yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Michalik.
Thank you.
Now I'd like to hear from a couple of doctors, Dr. Theodore Clark first, and then we'll have Dr. Brent Kohler next. Dr. Clark, thank you for coming today.
My pleasure. Good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to address the court. I'm Dr. Ted Clark. I'm a practicing orthopedic surgeon and the chairman and CEO of COPIC. COPIC provides medical liability insurance for 6,000 doctors and 100 hospitals and facilities in the state of Colorado. We're the dominant carrier here, and we've been in business since 1981. I submitted a written statement, and I want to emphasize that we applaud the project's goal of lowering litigation costs and hastening dispute resolutions. Mr. Fogg and Mr. O'Rourke and Ms. Hershey have given their written concerns that we have about the methods of achieving this goal, and I echo their concerns regarding the fairness of the new discovery rules, the limitations of experts in complex medical problems, and the inability to depose opposing experts. Obviously, with such experience in medical liability defense, we regret that we were not part of the process of creating the rules. I do not want to reiterate these legal concerns voiced by our attorneys. Rather, I'd like to turn my attention to the second participant in a medical malpractice suit, the physician. During my almost 30 years as a doctor, I have personally experienced the medical legal system twice, and I can relate to the experience of the thousands of doctors that we have and will represent in what we believe is a broken, inefficient, and ineffective system for evaluating our care and for compensating our injured patients. The response of the physician to a lawsuit is similar to that of a person with a serious illness. Denial, depression, rejection, and anger are common. This manifests itself in a variety of forms. It's no secret that the physician undergoing a lawsuit is less focused than his colleague. Unfortunately, the long-term consequences, even for the 80% of the cases that we prevail in, are horrific for the doctor. His attitude towards his patient and his practice changes. He is apt to change or limit his practice. Obstetricians become gynecologists. Doctors order more tests to cover themselves for potential liability. And surgeons refuse to go to the emergency room. In the extreme cases, physicians have retired, moved, and yes, unfortunately, even committed suicide because of accusations of malpractice. Accusations of medical malpractice is a personal assault on a physician's character and competence. It is more than a business decision when he or she decides to go to trial. A settlement or a lawsuit significantly impacts the physician. He or she is reported to the Board of Medical Examiners, the National Practitioner Data Bank, the various hospitals that he's on, and the health plans. It has a dramatic impact on his life. The consequence of the pilot project appears, from our perspective, to create more opportunities to sue physicians and healthcare providers. We believe there are other ways to expedite medical liability cases and to control legal costs that are fair to both parties. We point to the success of our early resolution called the 3Rs program for Recognize, Respond, and Resolve, and as an example that has benefited both patients and physicians to resolve their differences. We hope the court will hear our concerns about our lack of input in the modifications of the rules that so impact physicians and their patients.
Dr. Clark, is your primary objection to the rules the lack of being able to take depositions of expert witnesses, or are you more concerned on a broader base?
I think I'm more concerned on a broader basis, but I'm very concerned about the lack of being able to depose expert witnesses.
Could you explain a little bit more why you see these proposed rules as being harmful to doctors?
Well, so frequently we have multiple physicians in the same specialty involved in a lawsuit. It's I would say that 60 to 70% of our cases will have three or more doctors involved. And if you can only have, they have competing interests in the suit. And my understanding of the rules is that you're only going to be allowed to have one expert representing all of them who are in the same field, and you're not going to be able to depose them. That by itself creates some concerns.
The treating physicians are going to be, they can be deposed. I don't quite understand.
You have multiple treaters, and they're frequently also.
There's no limitation on deposing treating physicians, as I understood it.
Justice Bender, what I'm concerned about is your inability to depose the experts and your ability to have representation for the physicians who are involved.
With experts.
So you think if there are three gynecologists being sued, there can only be one expert for those three, and that person cannot be deposed. Is your understanding of these rules? You think it would be better addressed, of course, if there were depositions, but two, if those limits on experts were lifted?
I'm sorry,
do you think it would be better if there were depositions allowed of expert witnesses, but also if limits on the number of experts would be eliminated?
I think there are other ways of resolving the process, but having said that, in the current system, I think that you have to be able to depose the experts that are being called upon.
Other questions? No, thank you, Doctor. We appreciate you coming down today. And we have another doctor with us today, Dr. Brent, I think it's Keeler. Is that correct? Doctor, I apologize if I mispronounced your name. Is it Keeler?
It is.
Thank you, sir.
Excuse me. Thank you, Judge. Good afternoon, members of the court. May it please the court, my name is Brent Keeler, and I am the president-elect of the Colorado Medical Society. The society is a not-for-profit organization whose membership includes about 7,000 doctors in Colorado. For years, we have worked with lawmakers to support reforms that will improve the medical legal system. I'm here today because the pilot project, if adopted in its current form, will change the manner in which physicians interact with the legal system. Although some of the proposed rules have the medical community's full support, some of them have the potential to create a disadvantage for physicians when they defend against claims. I'm also here as a practicing physician. I have been practicing for almost 29 years. I'm a board certified OBGYN. I have medical staff privileges at two hospitals in the Greater Denver metro area. The highest privilege that I enjoy is delivering a baby. However, what I do carries great risk. Advances in medicine have lowered infant mortality to less than 1%. However, some deliveries are challenging, and babies can suffer injury during the birth process even when appropriate care is provided. Although medicine allows physicians to accomplish great things, medical professionals make countless judgments each day. I speak to you as a physician who has also been the subject of a medical malpractice claim, which is one of the most stressful and frightening experiences a physician may face. As a lawsuit progresses, a physician needs complete and accurate information to make potentially career-altering decisions, such as whether to proceed to trial or to resolve or settle a claim. To allow physicians to make this decision, it is really important that we have the ability to test the experts who have been endorsed against us, and that involves the pretrial deposition. While a written summary of the expert's opinion is beneficial in understanding the potential testimony, it cannot substitute for the ability to test the expert's opinion in advance of trial, and I know that from personal experience. A summary cannot substitute for the ability to probe the factual and scientific basis of the expert's opinion. Without this opportunity, physicians will not have the ability to make as informed a decision as we currently have. The medical community has some concerns about some of the other provisions, such as the simultaneous disclosure of expert witnesses. It seems at odds with our system to require physicians to defend themselves by submitting expert reports without knowing the specific criticisms against them. Our counsel has addressed these issues in her letters to the court. The medical community recognizes that medical malpractice litigation is expensive and time-consuming, as these costs are reflected in the medical malpractice insurance premiums that we pay each year. Indeed, we have long advocated for reforms to streamline the process. We support equitable and rational reforms that provide fairness to both patients and physicians. We object only to those provisions that deny physician defendants essential knowledge as the lawsuit progresses. The medical community was not involved in the drafting of the pilot, and we did not know of the proposed changes until very recently. And we are encouraged to hear that the committee is perhaps open to making changes, and we respectfully request that the court not implement the pilot project in its proposed form. Organized Medicine would like to work on addressing its concerns with the committee, while still achieving the goals of the project. If the court decides that it wishes to have medical community input and assistance, we stand ready to do so. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
All right, Dr. Keeler, thank you for coming down today. Appreciate it. I think the next speaker now is Curtis Shortridge, please. Mr. Shortridge.
Thank you, Justice Rice.
Welcome.
I don't want to reiterate here the comments that I made in my written materials. You've all had a chance to read them. I want to talk about basically two things. The first one is I represent almost exclusively people who are in business, have small businesses. I don't represent mega corporations. I don't represent wealthy people. I represent small businesses and medium-sized businesses and real estate brokers and brokerages. Thus, I have been in court in a lot of cases in the last 10 years on a variety of topics, both on the plaintiff side, far more limited than on the defense side. I think there's two problems that are being addressed here, and by lumping them together, there's a confused result. The first one is trying to find a way to get the smaller dollar cases through the court system more quickly and more efficiently. And that, in my experience, doesn't have anything to do with discovery or discovery costs. The limitations that were placed on discovery by Rule 26 many years ago have limited discovery in Colorado to the point where there is the right to take the deposition of each party and two other witnesses for each party in the case, as well as all the experts. Now, in many states, I'm sure that those sorts of limitations are not in place. However, here, we have those limitations in place in order to keep the costs down in civil litigation. And that, through my practice, has been very effective. And since those rules have been implemented, we have seen a dramatic, in my practice, decrease in the amount of discovery fights we've had. I hardly have a discovery fight anymore in most of the cases that I do. Discovery is simply not a real big problem, and it's not a large expense in any of the cases that I handle. Most of the cases that I handle, like most lawyers, settle. My percentage, as I keep track of it, looks to be about 98%, so I'm pretty close to the average. But one of the reasons why many of my cases are settling now that weren't in the past is because of ADR. I take great advantage of ADR, I use it a lot, and I think it's one of the principal reasons why we settle a lot more cases than we used to. So one of the reasons why fewer cases are going to trial these days, I think, is because we're using ADR. ADR has been promoted by this court for decades, and I think that the work that the bar, as well as the judges and the other people involved in the process, has considerably helped us to settle a lot more cases than we used to. Finally, as to experts, one thing I wanted to stress one thing, and that is that in the cases where I represent real estate brokers, an expert witness is involved in order to prove liability if there's a negligence claim. In a lot of those cases, the expert that is going to testify, who is a real estate broker, will provide an opinion that sometimes is contained in a written report, sometimes is not. But in many cases, it is an opinion that is completely out of sync with what most real estate professionals would know to be the standard of practice regarding that issue. Unfortunately, as the case is presented to the jury, one expert is going to give an opinion that is completely out of sync with what the real practice is. Another might give one that is more in sync with that practice. The only way for us, as the attorneys in the case, to deal with that issue is to have the time to take a deposition and to ferret out the ways in which that opinion does not actually characterize the practice within Colorado of being a real estate broker. And so to take away the right to do the deposition seriously impedes the right of my clients to properly take their case to trial and is a due process issue for them. Now, listening to
counsel, I'm sorry. Did you have one more sentence or so?
I have one more sentence.
Okay. I'll give you that for sure.
And then that is that in listening today and knowing a little bit I know about medical malpractice cases, I understand that the cost of experts and expert discovery in those cases is significant. In the cases I handle, at least with real estate brokers, the cost of hiring the experts and deposing them is a much smaller part of the case. It's probably, in my estimation, somewhere from 5 to at the most 10%, but it's usually more about 5, 6, 7% of the total cost of trying the case. It's simply not a very large part of the case. So to take that away is not saving very much money, but it is significantly depriving, I think, some people of their basic rights. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Appreciate you coming here today, Mr. Shortridge. I neglected to ask Carrie Hershey if she wanted to speak after Dr. Keeler. Did Carrie Hershey wish to speak? Yes, ma'am, you're here.
Your Honor, Dr. Keeler did such a nice job that unless the court has questions for me, I don't
know. You're counsel for the Colorado Medical Society? And did anyone have any questions following up on Dr. Keeler, who was the president of the Colorado Medical Society's comments? And there's nothing you wish to add?
No.
All right, thank you. Thank you for coming down. All right, well then let's go to Patrick O'Rourke, CU counsel, University of Colorado.
Thank you, Justice Rice and Chief Justice Bender, and may it please the court. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and I'd like to not rehash what's been said before, but primarily respond to some of the questions that have been asked. Before I do that, however, I wanted to point out one thing, which is that the rule is not clear as to whether or not it would apply to actions against governmental entities. I know that that was a subject that some of the members of the Attorney General's office had raised with former Justice Corliss, and I don't know whether there had been any discussion about whether or not this is applicable to governmental entities.
Do you think it should be?
As someone who represents medical malpractice professionals, I don't see our cases as being dramatically different, except in one respect, which is that under the Governmental Immunity Act, the filing of a notice of a motion under the Governmental Immunity Act automatically stays discovery. And we have various immunities and other jurisdictional defenses that we can raise that serve as a stay in discovery and that entitle us to interlocutory appeals. Certainly, the provisions of the rule as it's currently drafted, which don't stay discovery while a motion to dismiss is pending, are inconsistent with those statutes and those immunities. So I would at least think that there might be consideration of an amendment that if a subject matter jurisdiction challenge is raised in the trial court, that would prevent discovery from going forward. But I should mention that at the university, we don't have much in the way of traditional business litigation, and certainly a representative from the Attorney General's office who is handling the type of business litigation that involves the state of Colorado might take a completely different position than mine as to whether these rules should be more broadly applicable to other governmental entities, and I don't have any authority to speak on the Attorney General or the Solicitor General's behalf on that respect.
Thank you. Did you have some other comments?
I did.
Can I just follow up on that? So really, basically, what you're saying is obviously the rules have to follow the statute.
That's right.
There's no provision for that.
Yes, and I think that there are other immunities that have been recognized, for example, in federal law, qualified immunity that stays discovery and that we can then take interlocutory appeals. I think it would make sense to be parallel there to avoid forum shopping. The other two issues that I wanted to address very briefly were, Justice Rice, you asked about Mr. Mikulik's testimony as it related to the Alcon and Spicer cases and whether or not we should just overrule them. We have in the community that's defending these type of cases been struggling with those, and I know the trial court's been struggling because of in-camera reviews being caused by those cases, mainly because the plaintiffs and the defense have a fundamental disagreement about what the medical condition at issue in the case is and what that should lead discovery of. And I don't think that I would suggest that there be a broad waiver of Alcon and Spicer in medical malpractice cases. That might be reaching too far. But I would encourage these rules to be aggressive in saying that the trial court should be aggressive in implementing protective orders and require the parties to identify and tee up those residual privilege issues very quickly, because these rules will be frustrated if the parties are fighting over medical records, they're not able to get the information going back and forth, and that by mandating that a protective order goes into place that applies to the defendants, their counsel, the experts, and really implementing a regime of strong confidentiality while also encouraging them to resolve those issues quickly, that's going to make these rules effective. Finally, I share some of the same concerns that some of my colleagues have had about depositions, and you asked about, well, what's the middle position? Mr. Fogg mentioned one of the things that I discussed, which was I think that one of the problems is that we're in a regime right now where a party can endorse multiple experts and force upon their opponents a very burdensome obligation in deposing them. I think some cost shifting there would make parties be selective in who they endorse as experts. Think, do I need to have three experts talk about standard of care if I'm going to be responsible for all the costs of their discovery? And make me internalize that. And I think the other thing that hasn't been suggested yet is that certainly there are cases, and there are defense lawyers and plaintiff's attorneys say, I have to depose all these experts. If there exists the possibility to say, pick two. Pick the experts that you really need to hear their opinions and take those depositions so that you can evaluate your case and decide whether or not to take it to trial. That you don't have to depose every expert, you don't have to over-endorse experts, but that you shouldn't take away what is, in many respects, a very useful tool in some cases in helping them resolve. Some of the plaintiff's attorneys who served on the committee, such as Ms. Brown and Ms. Thompson, testified today. The main reasons that I've settled a lot of cases with those folks is because in their depositions, I haven't been able to shake their experts, or they've come to my experts' depositions and beat them senseless, and I realize this case needs to go to trial, and I'd rather know that before I get there and get 6 days into trial.
Mr. Warwick, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Let's see. I understand that Joseph Batwello is going to be speaking now in place of Thomas Kressel. Is that correct? Yes. Thank you for coming today.
Members of the court, my name is Joseph Batwello. I'm an internal medicine physician practicing hospital medicine in Aurora. I'm also an attorney with the firm of Kressel & Johnson. I was previously of counsel to a plaintiff's medical malpractice firm. I've been a retained expert witness, and I have reviewed scores of medical records on behalf of both plaintiffs and defendants. As a physician, I would reiterate that the consequences of a medical malpractice action have consequences far beyond the amount of damages sought or awarded, and for this reason, matters of proportionality cannot be weighed on this issue alone. The Colorado Lawyer article that was published this month regarding the pilot project twice made reference to the opportunity to experiment with the litigation process. Please be aware that in my practice as a physician, if I wish to experiment with anything that has any potential at all to affect the health, well-being, or personal dignity of a patient, even in ways that may seem trivial, I must first obtain their informed consent and approval from an institutional review board. Patients have a right to consent to interventions that affect their health and bodily integrity, and a similar principle should apply to litigants regarding experiments that affect their rights to present and defend against claims. The proposed rules, particularly those limiting expert witness discovery, seem to reflect a misunderstanding of the nature of medical expert opinion. Expert witnesses are not investigators. A patient's chart in a medical malpractice action typically contains hundreds or thousands of pages of data, and it is neither efficient nor practical for a retained expert to scour reams of documents for the minute but potentially relevant facts that might influence his or her opinion. Expert witnesses typically form their opinions based on the abridged data presented to them after investigation by attorneys. An expert might be given materials that omit an item that counsel deems insignificant or that was simply overlooked, but which might ultimately change that expert's opinion. Prohibiting expert depositions deprives the parties, the experts, and ultimately the court and jury of valuable opportunities to discover and understand circumstances of the case. It is disrespectful to jurors to subject them to incomplete, inconsistent, and irrelevant testimony that might have been refined in pretrial discovery. Medicine is very much an art. Medical experts cannot do destructive testing on patients. Doctors do not have the luxury of taking patients apart and swapping out parts to discover the source of malfunction. Physicians must often rely on fragmentary and nonspecific data to make diagnostic and treatment decisions. Experts quite often have differing interpretations of the same data, and it is not surprising that they come to different conclusions on similar facts. Depositions are not mandatory. They persist as part of medical malpractice litigation for the simple fact that they are extremely useful. Detailed expert reports are no substitute for depositions. At best, they are the functional equivalent of depositions at which only the endorsing party gets to ask questions. With regard to limiting the number of expert witnesses to one per issue or one per specialty, this again reflects misunderstanding of how medicine is practiced. Even Aristotle realized that an issue such as causation could not be adequately explored from a single perspective. A similar complexity affects determining cause in medical cases. If, for example, a diabetic patient loses a foot to an infected ulcer, it may be equally valid to claim that he lost the foot to diabetes, to infection, to vascular disease, or finally, because a surgeon removed it with a saw. In such a case, a single expert with a single perspective may be insufficient to convey a complete understanding of causation.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate you coming here today. Let's see. The next person is William Babich. Is he here, please? Thank you, Mr. Babich. Mr. Babich? Oh, I thought I saw somebody standing up. All right. He's not here, I guess. Mr. Babich? No? All right, then. Mr. Holm, Dick Holm. Did you wish to make some comments, sir? John?
May it please the court. I support the rules, the proposed rules. I think the opportunity to have a two-year period where we can find out whether it works and whether or not we can improve our system is extremely desirable. And aside from that, I trust that the members of the court will be able to suppress their glee at the fact that I'm going to waive the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Holm. Now let's see, Skip Netzorg wishes to speak, please. Mr. Netzorg.
Thank you, Justice Rice, Chief Justice Bender, and members of the court, and we very much appreciate you having this. We know the amount of time you've put into it. I wanted to address two short matters and then talk a little bit about an overview from the committee standpoint, and I'll do it in 3 minutes. On the motions to dismiss, we have set the rules up very much like they're set up in federal court so that the few cases that may potentially be dismissed don't hold the rest hostage while nothing can happen for many, many, many months in cases. In one case, I've got for over a year.
What about the governmental immunity kinds of cases, statutory?
Yeah, Your Honor, I think that is a legitimate issue. I think it's certainly something that we can take into account. And I think our suggestion is there have been a number of issues, and Judge Frick named some of them, that we would like to look at because we think they're really good suggestions, and then come back to the court with suggestions for the court to examine those suggestions. So I see that as being completely consistent. I also wanted to draw the court's attention to Rule 10.3, and actually 10.2 and 3. 10.2 says, except in extraordinary cases, one expert per side will be permitted in a given specialty. Then 10.3 addresses many of these issues that we've been talking about. And I think that although I wasn't immersed in the drafting of this, of the medical malpractice rules, the people that were on both sides of this argument, and they provided as follows. There shall be a presumptive limit of one expert per side in a given specialty unless the parties are able to demonstrate a lack of commonality. So they've addressed that issue. I think that the other issues that may come up on experts are provided for very, very well in the rules, and particularly with respect to the expert conference that the rules contemplate having.
What's lack of commonality mean? Just explain that for me.
As I understand it from Mr. Dickinson, and we had days of discussion about this, there may be multiple defendants who are physicians, and although they may be in the same specialty, as you heard from one of the former persons that talked to you, they may have a different perspective, they may have different issues, they may have different interests completely on liability, on damages, etc. So if a party can demonstrate that the issue is different from their physician's standpoint, as I understand it, then they're going to be entitled to their own expert on that issue. But if they can't, they shouldn't get an expert.
Thank you. What did Judge Frick mean when she said you might want to tinker with the definition or the wording of commonality? Didn't she say that?
I don't recall that.
Okay, I may be wrong. Sorry.
I know I'm about out of time. I just wanted to emphasize that what we're trying to do here is change the paradigm from the
all-you-can-eat model to the get-what-you-need model, because we are driving people away from the judicial system, and we are in danger of making our court system irrelevant. And you can take any five people from any five persuasions, whether they're plaintiffs, defendants, lawyers, judges, and you can ask them what they think about the trial process. And a good example is, if somebody has a simple promissory note case, they can pretty well expect they're going to be producing their tax returns, personal data that has nothing to do with it. People are going to be asking for unfiled public or documents that are drafts of public documents. It's just gotten out of hand, and we need to revise the rules so that we've got parameters that work, and so the courts know what to do with this as well. And thank you.
All right, thank you.
If you have any questions, I'd be happy to.
Doesn't appear so. Thank you, Mr. Netzwerk. Let's see, Chief Judge Janice Davidson, please, of the Court of Appeals. Judge Davidson.
Chief Justice Bender, members of the court. May it please the court. I want to speak to you very briefly as a member of the Pilot Project Committee, but I also want to speak to you as a person who's been in the judicial system for 26 years and been on the Rules Committee, the Civil Rules Committee, for 23 years, and consider myself deeply immersed in the issues of providing rules that make for fair and accessible and litigation that is not unduly costly and burdensome to the people that we serve. I am strongly in favor of this project. I strongly urge you to adopt it. I think some of the suggestions that have been made here can be incorporated, but some of the more major ones I think would actually just undercut the whole underpinnings of this, which is to make a radical type of departure in the idea of a pilot project that will see whether or not we can accumulate data that shows that we actually can save money, make cases more expeditious, more timely, and more available to the citizens who need to use them. I agree, this proposal goes way beyond more than tweaking the rules, but I think the time has come to go beyond tweaking the rules. The driving premise of a pilot project is to determine what we need to do, get the data so we can figure out what's wrong, what works, and what doesn't work. There will be possible things that come out of these rules that don't work. And if they don't, or if the data comes in that either they are make things more cumbersome or more expensive or more burdensome, obviously they'll be discarded. But if we don't move and step aside and look at this, as Skip Netzwerk said, in a different paradigm, we're never going to change anything. And the frustration that I think I have felt from being involved in this system for so long and trying so many times through changes in civil rules and just getting deeper and deeper into issues of access to civil justice has made me ecstatically happy about the idea of something that is different enough that might produce a system that literally opens up courthouse doors to people now who can't have access.
And part of that is that victims can't get justice because there's too much array on the other side and it's too expensive,
it's
right?
It's too expensive. Not only does it take too long and it's cumbersome, but it's just too expensive.
And attorneys won't take the cases.
That's
so these people have to represent themselves.
That's correct. And I didn't participate in creating each of the sets of rules, but the people who did were from both sides of the aisle, were from both walks, if I may just finish my sentence, from both disciplines, both plaintiff and defense in both areas. And this is a collection of wisdom from people who are highly accomplished in these fields who said, okay, we'll each have a little bit of our ox, we'll get gored, but we'll come together with a system that perhaps we can make better for everyone. So again, I urge you to take this opportunity and let this pilot project go forward. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much, Chief Judge Davidson. And in our final scheduled speaker for the afternoon is former Justice Rebecca Curlis. Justice Curlis.
Justice Rice, Chief Justice Bender, members of the court, thank you for taking the time to hear everyone out this afternoon.
I thank both on behalf of the Institute and on behalf of the committee, everybody who appeared here today, presented written comments and oral comments. I have three sort of closing cleanup remarks for you all. And I have to note that it's a little odd to be on this side of the red carpet.
It probably feels pretty good from your side.
I wouldn't like it.
The notion of a pilot project, although I understand that if you happen to be the litigant in a pilot project, it doesn't feel much like a pilot project. It feels like absolutely everything that impacts your life. But the notion is that we have a duty to improve the process. And if we don't use pilot projects, we are consigned either to broad-based changes without the data to know whether those changes are right, or the status quo. And I would suggest that a pilot project is the best of those alternatives. Now, the only way that a pilot project works is if we measure. And my real purpose in addressing you is to confirm that the Institute stands ready to do that measurement, both in terms of collaborating with the State Court Administrator's Office to try to collect hard data, and also in terms of administering surveys to litigants, judges, and lawyers as we go through this process, largely on a time frame that you all might suggest. We are of the view that it's going to take 2 years to collect data that will be meaningful. But if you want data on a more regularized basis, we will certainly see if we can do that. In the end, we all have to work toward the promise of Rule 1, a just, speedy, and inexpensive system for the resolution of disputes. We think that these pilot rules are a step in that direction. Other participants in the committee, and I was not on the committee, but the Institute staffed the committee. I would urge you to adopt these rules, and let's give it a try. Thank you.
Thank you, Justice Corliss. Now, according to my list, I've now called upon everyone who signed up to speak, and I hope that's correct. I don't think that I have missed anybody, and I don't see anybody waving their arms suggesting that I'm incorrect. All right, thank you, Chief Justice Bender.
Thank you all for coming. We stand adjourned.